Just going to run this dog to see if we can find any type of human remains that are left.
Listen to Where Secrets Go to Die, The Disappearance of Derek Hennigan. From the Detroit Free Press, a new podcast set in the woods of Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Available on Apple, Spotify, Freep.com, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Inside Florida Politics, powered by Gannett. The Florida House puts out a redistricting map that could significantly boost the number of congressional seats Republicans control in the state. A bill aimed at making school board races partisan battlegrounds advances in the legislature, and Florida Democrats gathered for their big annual meeting. Hello, I'm Sarasota Herald Tribune political editor Zach Anderson, and those are some of the stories I'll be discussing this week with Gannett State Capitol reporter John Kennedy and Palm Beach Post politics editor Antonio Finns. But first, that music means it's time for some numbers. Gentlemen, I hope you had a great Thanksgiving. I hope you stuffed yourselves full of turkey and maybe stuffed away a few podcast numbers for us. John, how about you?
Zach, this time of the year, I'm already thinking more of the 12 days of Christmas, but I do have a number this week, and it's 4,318.
4,318. I think a lot of people are thinking about Christmas. Antonio, you got a number for us?
Yeah, I do, but a lot simpler than John's. Mine is just simply 4.
All right. And I'm right in the middle with an 8. Remember those numbers, folks. We'll tell you what they mean in Florida politics at the end of the show. Well, the first round of redistricting maps put out by the Florida Senate didn't offer much intrigue. In fact, it surprised some political observers who expected it to be more heavily gerrymandered to help Republicans. Well, this week, the Florida House had its turn at the maps, and they were more along the lines of what Democrats had been fearing. John, fill us in on the details.
Well, you're right, Zach. The House has put out two maps redrawing the state's congressional districts, and indeed, they heavily favor the state's ruling Republicans. In fact, the number of Republican-leaning seats would increase by 1 in one map and 2 in the other. The state currently has 16 Republican members of Congress, and the maps produced by the House would create 17 or 18 districts that would likely elect a Republican candidate. Now, by contrast, the Democrats had been sort of lulled into some sense of peace with the 4 state Senate maps that had been put in play for congressional districts. Those basically kept the state's partisan balance with 16 Republican districts to 12 for Democrats. The state is gaining a seat next year because of population gains, and it's the Democrats who actually gain an additional seat under the Senate plans. But remember, there is pressure on Florida Republicans. The GOP nationally is looking to increase its congressional seats to take control of the U.S. House, take it away from Democrats. But Florida Republicans, especially those in the Senate, they may be seeking to avoid a repeat of the 3 years of lawsuits and depositions, hearings and trials, which followed redistricting back in 2012. It was ultimately the courts in 2015 that drew the state's current congressional and Senate boundaries, but the House plan that year, approved by legislators in 2012, that went unchallenged by Democrats and voter groups, which found, and the courts agreed, wholesale gerrymandering in that round of redistricting. So here we are 10 years later. How is this going to unfold? The Senate is drawing boundaries for Senate districts, and the House is doing the same for the House seats. But the congressional map that we're talking about here, that's the thing, that's the product that's going to have to be some kind of consensus between the two sides. So, we're looking at a little bit more of a contested issue right now, at least at this point. It's notable that a lot of Democrats and some interest groups have quietly endorsed the Senate plan, even though it leaves Democrats at a distinct disadvantage in terms of the Florida congressional delegation. But Democrats seem to acknowledge that the population shifts and the politics of the state don't really favor them. Get out of this latest round of redistricting with something like the status quo, they'll consider that a victory. But then the other question is, can Florida Republicans go back to U.S. House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy and say, we've got our plans and, you know, we don't really pick up any seats in Florida. You know, remember, Democrats hold a wafer thin edge in Congress, and McCarthy wants to be the next speaker and help stifle President Biden's agenda after next November's elections. But, you know, a path to this, to his possible victory probably includes some kind of gain in Florida and some other real, you know, bellwether states. And the House maps right now give him that. Comparing the House and Senate maps, the House map creates two Democratic-leaning districts in the Tampa Bay area, while the Senate proposed three. Similarly, in Central Florida, seats controlled by currently by Democrats Stephanie Murphy, Darren Soto, and Val Demings, who's a candidate for U.S. Senate, they get combined into only two seats likely to elect a Democrat. That's probably going to erase Murphy, since the two districts that are surviving seem to be kind of minority-leaning districts. There's some areas of agreement between the House and Senate, though, like the Senate plans. The House proposals also increase voter registration numbers for Republicans in a pair of Miami-Dade districts where they were flipped from Democrats in last fall's elections. The seats held by the freshman Republican reps Maria Salazar and Carlos Jimenez were made more favorable for electing a Republican member. So they have a strong chance of getting reelected in next year's, you know, critical elections. But the House approach would undoubtedly land it in court, facing challenges that, you know, Republicans are gerrymandering these districts that would conflict with the Florida Constitution, which prohibits deliberately drawing boundaries that favor or disfavor incumbents or a particular party. That's basically what got us the 3 years of lawsuits a decade ago. But remember, you know, this time around, Senate President Wilton Simpson, he's a Republican running for the statewide office of agriculture commissioner. He doesn't want to be tagged as endorsing unconstitutional plans, and nor does he want to spend, you know, next campaign season giving depositions and sitting on a witness stand in a courtroom. So, you know, all that may be a contributing factor to how this House-Senate map model unfolds. We'll see. It's still in the early stages, and this redistricting effort is not likely to really wrap up until the legislature completes the 2022 session in mid-March. So it's still a moving target right now.
And John, what's the current partisan breakdowns? What, 15 to 12? Or
It's 16, 11, with one seat still to be decided, a likely Democratic seat that's going to be the subject of a January 11th election.
So Republicans currently have 16 seats, and they could go up to possibly around 18 in this new map. So they could pick up two seats, basically, potentially. And that, with the very tight Democratic margin in Congress, could make a huge difference. Right.
Yeah. I think nationally, about five seats, a swing of about five seats would hand control of Congress to the Republicans. Potentially, Florida could get them almost halfway there.
Yeah. So you know, this is a big deal here, and you know, it's interesting to see where you have the Senate being pretty conservative, not too aggressive in reconfiguring these districts, and the House, you know, much more aggressive in kind of recrafting this in ways that could benefit Republicans. It seems like maybe there's an internal debate here within the GOP, and that there's going to be some negotiations going forward, and we'll see where they land next year. Well, as Florida Democrats brace for an unfavorable political climate in 2022 that could be made more unfavorable by redistricting, they're gathering this weekend in Orlando to try and get organized for that tough year ahead. Antonio, there hasn't been much good news for Florida Democrats lately. Ron DeSantis looks like he's going to be tough to beat, and the party's voter registration advantage has evaporated. How big of a challenge do you think it will be for party leaders to sort of rally the troops this weekend?
Well, you're right, man. There hasn't been a lot of good news for them. And it's going on nearly three decades since a Democrat won a governor's race in Florida. And these Florida Democratic Party confabs in recent years have been more soul-searching, mea culpa postmortems than actual pre-election year pep rallies precisely because of that string of defeats. Hey, look, I spoke to a Democratic communications specialist this week who will be attending the Orlando meeting to get insights on what she thought needs to get accomplished in Central Florida. The answer she told me was basically down to messaging, messaging, and more messaging. You know, the first thing to address, she said, is how we ourselves actually even started this conversation. I said, by not dwelling on the shadow of defeat. This Democratic comms expert said the first thing the party needs to do is to look forward and not past, and to look forward by focusing on some successes. For starters, this Democrat said, you know, Florida's Democratic congressional delegation is bringing big dollars to Florida through the recently passed infrastructure legislation. That's on top of the aid to the state from the stimulus bill last spring, that the Biden bucks that DeSantis and Republicans actually took credit for, even as they panned and badmouthed the legislation as wasteful spending. That's a perfect example of, you know, sort of the Democrats not really having effective messaging, allowing DeSantis and the GOP to sort of steal the thunder from them. The Democrats, she said, need to tell that story about the success in this legislation. And she also said they need to capitalize on the popularity of the Biden economic agenda with the public, as polls show Americans supporting key pieces of that legislative package. Then she said, you know, they need to hear from the Democratic gubernatorial candidates, Charlie Crist, Nikki Fried, and Annette Tadeo, about how they are going to hold the DeSantis accountable for what she said was DeSantis' COVID mismanagement. Bottom line, she said, you know, Democrats need to leave Orlando with a forward-looking roadmap to victory in 2022 that stresses achievements and puts the GOP under a heat lamp. And they need to have a plan to spend money to drive home that message, get Democratic voters to the polls, and win over independent voters. Look, it's hard to argue with that logic. It makes a lot of sense. The only problem is these are goals that have proven so elusive so often for statewide Florida Democratic candidates in midterm election years. And you have DeSantis, who has rolled up a lot of campaign cash and who has an effective targeted campaign message. He kept the economy open. And who has easy targets to attack Democrats on, such as higher gasoline prices. Look, it's going to be an uphill fight. And to have any chance, what I've heard is Democrats need to come out of Orlando and go into 2022 with sharp and well-funded message.
Antonio, I think if Democrats were smart, they would have held this meeting in Miami and focused it very heavily on how do you reach out to Hispanic voters, because that's really how they got killed in this last election, by just, you know, not being able to put up the same margins that they had in Miami in the past. And if they can't figure that out, there's no way that the Democratic Party is going to be competitive in any election going forward. I mean, it was an absolute disaster there for them, wasn't it?
Yeah. And quite frankly, going down to Miami, as I do frequently, I can tell you that all those where I would go into these bastions, Republican bastions of Westchester and, you know, Kendall and so forth, those areas that came out in such full force for Trump in 2020, I can tell you that all those Trump flags, they've been replaced by Cuban flags. And a lot of Patria y Vida messaging. And that's going to be an Achilles heel for the Biden administration when Republicans go to these bastions and basically say, hey, you saw what happened in the summer in Havana. Where was the Biden administration? What did they do? And they're going to have a real uphill fight. So who knows? Maybe it was smarter maybe to have a roll of dice with, you know, the Puerto Rican enclaves in Central Florida, because I'm telling you, getting Cuban, particularly conservative Cuban-American voters and any kind of a conservative Hispanic voter in those bastions in Miami-Dade is almost, you know, almost out the door right now.
And now you have problems potentially with Colombian voters, with this FARC, this communist revolutionary group in Colombia being delisted as a terrorist group. I mean, that's caused a bit of an uproar in Miami as well, right?
It has. And in fact, on Friday, the RNC is having a big, you know, statement, you know, presser type gathering on that. Look, that's a little bit more complicated than they make it out to seem. But we saw how the socialist label was so damaging to Democrats in Miami-Dade in 2020. And they Republicans have been very effective. You talk about, you know, what this Democratic strategist was telling me about messaging. Well, Republicans in Miami-Dade have been really good about messaging for a long time. And not just with this whole question of socialism in Cuba, but even when it comes to small businesses and, you know, explaining, you know, why, you know, lower regulations and lower taxes really appeals to small businesses and how it will help them thrive and prosper. They've been really good at that for a long time.
Well, obviously, like things like this FARC issue are complicated, but Republicans seem to have a way of simplifying it in a way that has resonated with voters in similar circumstances in the past. Well, even as Republicans look to be in a strong position heading into 2022, they aren't satisfied with their current reach and are hoping to make inroads in nonpartisan school board races. A bill pushed by Sarasota State Senator Joe Gruters that advanced in the legislature this week would make school board contests partisan races where you have, you know, Democrat or Republican, an R or D or, you know, a no party affiliation or whatever party you're registered with next to your name, just like races up higher up the ballot. That bill comes as school boards have turned into battlegrounds over issues such as mask mandates, and conservatives have expressed frustration with boards that they view as too liberal. John, this seems like another outgrowth of the COVID wars. What are the arguments for and against this?
Well, the Senate sponsor of the legislation, Joe Gruters of Sarasota, he's a Republican who doubles as the Florida Republican Party chairman. He says that Florida school board races already have plenty of partisan undertones to them.
And he's not wrong about that,
yeah,
right?
The parties
are involved in these races on the sidelines.
Yeah, they kind of pick their favorites. You know, the candidates run without party labels now, and they have for, 25 years in Florida. He said that each major party often endorses a school board candidate in the county, and various partisan activist organizations, you know, unions and clubs, they also weigh in with an endorsement. All that is true. So Gruters concludes from that, you know, making these offices partisan is just adding transparency for the voter. Of course, you know, he also had to acknowledge that since Florida is a closed primary state, it also would mean that only Republican registered voters who vote in the Republican primary would choose a school board candidate for the general election, and the same with the Democrats. The non-party affiliated voters who are many would get to vote only in the general election. Now, Gruter's proposal is aimed at changing the state constitution, so it has to go before voters next year. Opponents, though, who at the legislature's first hearing this week on the subject, they were all Democrats that opposed it. They saw it as adding another level of volatile, polarizing politics to school boards, which as you pointed out, they've been the target in recent weeks of so much hostility and threats. Not to mention these hours-long school board meetings caused by division, mostly over mask requirements, it seems. But of course, everybody amps up a lot of conspiracy theories that they want to air to school board members before, a school board member starts talking about, various much more mundane classroom matters, But in this first hearing on Gruter's bill, one Democratic senator, Tina Pulsky of Boca Raton, she pointed out that she thought we needed less politics, not more politics in schools and in school board races. I think a lot of people have thoughts of school board candidates going, full partisan under this idea. They're going to start wearing MAGA hats or pledging their support for President Biden's Build Back Better plan, political issues that seem to go far beyond the classroom needs of a local community. For Gruters, it's kind of interesting, too. The partisan politics idea has a twist in that Sarasota County last year, school board member Eric Robinson, a former county Republican chair and Gruter's own business partner in an accounting firm, he was defeated by Tom Edwards, a political newcomer who campaigned heavily on his support for traditional public schools. And one of the raps against Robinson that maybe contributed to his defeat was that he was identified as too much of a political partisan. Gruters didn't specifically mention the Robinson defeat, but he acknowledged that this year's clash between 11 county school boards, including Sarasota, and Governor DeSantis over the governor's opposition to mask mandates, that did help inspire this legislation. School board members in 10 of the counties were ultimately ordered to have their pay docked by the State Board of Education for challenging DeSantis. That's a dispute that brought the Biden administration in to help fund some of the lost pay. Sarasota avoided the fines by dropping its mask requirement. But Florida's not alone in this fight. You know, mask fights in across the nation have prompted the FBI to set up to kind of step up what they're already doing in tracking threats, this time against board members and teachers and school administrators. Some Republicans in Congress turned around and cited this action by the Biden administration as trying to intimidate or silence parents who object to local school policies. And, Florida's own Ron DeSantis last month said he wouldn't work with federal agencies that are looking to, blunt such threats. He called it a slap in the face to local law enforcement. So, against this backdrop, here's an idea to change Florida law and make school board races partisan. I don't know how much, more amped up we need the politics of Florida, but this is an idea that's going to, make its way through the legislature next year.
And these races have become increasingly partisan over the years. Sure. Just like city races are nonpartisan as well. But the parties get involved. But Antonio, it does seem like for school races that these mask wars have really ramped this up, haven't they?
Yeah, they have. One of the things I've been looking for is at what point do these anti-vax, anti-mask advocates that have been showing up at school board meetings, for example, here in Palm Beach County and even earlier at county commission meetings, at what point do they transition from protest lines to entering into the public service arena? And now among the four candidates that have qualified to run for the mayor of Boynton Beach here in Palm Beach County is an anti-mask, anti-vaccine advocate, who, by the way, is facing trial later this month on an arrest last year for refusing to leave a Boca Raton Einstein's Brothers bagel shop after she entered without a facial covering and then was asked to leave and the police showed up. And she is now facing a misdemeanor charge or going on trial for a misdemeanor charge of trespassing and resisting an officer without violence. Now, this activist, Cindy Falco de Corrado, is a retiree and a Florida artist here. She's representing herself, and she told Palm Beach Post reporter Jorge Milian this week that she did nothing wrong and not guilty, and she will defend herself. But look, it's interesting. Falco de Corrado has been kind of an interesting past here. At one point, she was on a CRA board in Boynton Beach and then had to resign after making some bigoted comments. She's somebody who has drawn attention, showing up at Palm Beach County Commission meetings. And one, she gave this rant where she demanded of the county commissioners, quote unquote, where do you derive the authority to regulate human breathing? Yeah, that was her. And then there's that photo outside what apparently was a school board meeting to discuss masks, where Falco de Corrado posted on social media this photo of her with the Proud Boys as the Proud Boys flash those white power signs with their hands. So here we are, with Falco de Corrado being one of four candidates that are, with a shot to be the mayor of Boynton Beach. Now you can say, well, okay, yeah, she's kind of a fringe candidate and she's going up against some Boynton Beach heavyweights, City Commissioner Ty Pinserga, a community activist Bernard Wright, and third candidate. So, look, yeah, she's a fringe candidate, maybe doesn't have much of a chance to win. But again, it shows how in this political environment, people that were on the fringe now have a seat at the political table. Yeah, maybe voters will decide that seat at the political table is way at the other end. But nonetheless, they have a seat at the table, and it just shows how the political arena has really altered in the last 5 to 10 years.
Yeah, and just in general, some of these people might be more fringe than others, but it's interesting to watch just how the COVID wars, how much that sparks people to get involved in politics and actually run for office. You're seeing these battles in school board meetings, how many of these people run for school board? How many of them run for other offices like the one you mentioned, like for mayor and other things? I mean, you saw that with like the Tea Party movement and other, movements, that were kind of backlashes to things. And so I think that is one thing that everybody will be watching for this election cycle is how much did this kind of mobilize people who weren't otherwise all that interested in politics to get out and get involved, and how successful are they?
Now, the school board idea still has a long way to go, we have to admit, in that, it's something that it's going to have to win approval from 60% of both the House and Senate. And then that's how it would get on the ballot. And then, of course, the proposed constitutional amendment would go before voters in November next year, where more than 60% would have to approve it to become law. So there's, quite a few steps needed to be taken before you get to pick your school board member openly based on their politics. But it does. It raises the question about, is every school board election now going to become sort of a national political event? And Antonio, as you point out, the mayoral candidate in Boynton Beach, who stood her ground in an Einstein bagel shop, maybe that becomes the way you get elected to a city council now.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, it's already happened. I remember during the last two election cycles where county commissioners, people running for local offices, local government offices, were getting asked about Trump and the presidential race. And there's probably examples where people used, Trump or attack Trump or pro Trump in mailers for these local races. So I don't know that it hasn't already happened. Schools seem to be a little bit of a different ball game. I mean, you're talking about, trying to do what's in the best interests of kids and I think a lot of people, not all, would think that that is really a bipartisan, should be more bipartisan. But, it has become a pretty rancorous political battleground over the last year or so. Well, we'll move on to some numbers. John, you want to tell us about yours?
Yeah, Zach, my 4,318. That is the lead that Florida Republicans now have over Democrats in voter registration statewide. That is the first lead for the Florida Republican Party in modern state history. Zach, you wrote about this about a month ago when Governor DeSantis mentioned it in a speech before the National Conference of State Legislatures. He was saying that this milestone had been reached. At that time, he based it on kind of internal Republican Party numbers that showed that the party had finally surpassed Democrats in voter registration. But just last week, the Florida Division of Election posted reports that confirm this switcheroo. It may have been appropriately symbolic that the date that the latest voter registration numbers are compiled through is October 31st, Halloween, because the switch from voter registration dominance for Democrats has some pretty spooky overtones for a party in the state that many people are basically giving up for dead, even as another governor's election is on the near horizon. But Democrats haven't held the governor's mansion now in 23 years, and the legislature has been in Republican control even longer, 25 years. So you had voter registration, though, that had always been something that Democrats had managed to maintain a lead and basically could generate some hope from, but maybe not so much anymore. You're seeing what has been a constant influx of new residents in Florida. The retirement mecca, the Villages, was the nation's fastest growing area in the most recent census. That is likely not helping Democratic voter registration, with the perception being that many of these new arrivals are leaning Republicans, especially among older voters. But the state is also becoming more diverse, which may be a potential area of growth for Democrats. But they're going to have to get this mostly Hispanic demographic of voters to their side. It's tough for Democrats, though, in the state being out of power on a state level. There's only so many opportunities for activists to play a role and feel that they can make change on a larger level. although, you know, Florida's biggest cities remain pretty decidedly Democratic. So, you know, as it stands now, there are 5.1 million Republicans and 5.1 million registered Democrats, with the Republicans holding that just over 4,000 voter edge. You know, when Democrats were last holding the governor's mansion, they held a 400,000 voter registration edge over Democrats, I'm sorry, over Republicans in the state. But, you know, that was from a political time that is fading in the mists of history now. The real wild card in Florida will be the 3.8 million no party affiliated voters whose uncertain party leanings will keep the state at least something of a toss-up in statewide and national campaigns. But demographic trends and just the pattern of change and the aggressive voter registration efforts by Republicans also kind of suggest that the party is probably going to be widening that lead over Democrats as the months go on. So, you know, my conclusion from all this, it's not that analytical. It's basically Florida is now a purple state whose shade is a lot more red than blue. You know, is that magenta? I don't know. Not so good at colors. And you know, how about this analysis? I think even Democrats would agree with this. It's tough being a Democrat in Florida.
Yeah, that might be the motto of their gathering in Orlando this weekend. That make for a very hopeful banner for them. Antonio, you want to tell us about your number?
But first, I'm rifling through my crayon box to find out what exactly that color is. Yeah, I had 4, as in 4%, and that is the unemployment rate in Florida. Now, while we were away the last couple of weeks, the state near the end of November released the most recent labor market monthly survey, and that was for October, and it showed a labor market recovery from the pandemic shutdown. After all, you know, economists have long held that 4% is the threshold for full employment, meaning every eligible worker who is out there looking for work can find a job. And that's where we are at, 4%. And in fact, in Palm Beach County, we have had 4 straight months where the number of job openings far exceeds the number of people who have said that they are looking for work. So the question is, where are the workers? If you recall, Governor Ron DeSantis in the spring cited a shortage of workers plus a number of job openings across the state as the reason he was stopping Floridians from collecting the extra federal unemployment benefit. On conservative media, economists and pundits alike blamed the jobless benefits for the worker shortage here and across the country and intimated that workers would rather stay home collecting government checks than work. Yet here we are. We have near full employment, and still companies report they are having big time challenges hiring people. In fact, one top analyst told me this last week that the biggest industry in Florida, tourism, is said to be down anywhere from 10% to 40% in staffing. Those employers across the board who are having success hiring are doing so because they are offering much higher wages, 401k retirement plans, signing bonuses, and full medical and dental coverage. It is, as a top career source Palm Beach County official told me, a decidedly job seekers market out there. So it's tempting to conclude that the political narrative that unemployment benefits were a disincentive to work was false. And the real reason is that the pandemic has altered the economy and the labor market. Rather than working restaurant jobs, for example, people are opting to deliver packages for Amazon. And many other opportunities in fields like professional business services, health, and education have opened up. And Floridians are opting to fill those jobs instead. Then there is the other issue, immigration. I'm hearing, too, that the push to crack down on the border and stressing professional skilled immigrants over non-skilled ones is aggravating the worker shortage. Remember, Florida has a disproportionately large tourism and hospitality industry, and that industry has long depended on low-skilled immigrants. Cracking down on their availability and sending the message that you are not welcome in America if you aren't a brain surgeon or a physicist could be a reason why now there aren't enough housekeepers to clean hotel rooms, or why a restaurant here is offering busboys $15 an hour, which is interesting because remember that whole debate over $15 minimum wage? Well, I'm told that the de facto minimum wage in Palm Beach County is close to $16. Progressives may say this is all poetic justice, but I say it's simply supply and demand capitalism. And it was Adam Smith and the Wealth of Nations who was right, and Karl Marx and the Communist Manifesto that was wrong.
All right. Important number to watch in Florida, and a very good one with the unemployment being where it is. My number is 8, as in 8 months ago in April of 2021, that the first case of the Delta COVID-19 variant was discovered in Florida. It didn't take long for Delta to explode in this state, leading to a record number of new infections and hospitalizations. And now we have a new variant of concern, the Omicron variant. Omicron hasn't been detected in Florida yet, but it seems inevitable. There's a lot we don't know, especially whether it is more deadly or more infectious. But we do know that whatever happens with Omicron, Florida won't be taking aggressive steps to contain it. As Delta wreaked havoc in the state, killing thousands of people, Governor Ron DeSantis became increasingly hostile to any COVID-19 public health mandates. Delta brought the school mask wars, battles over vaccine mandates in Florida. But Omicron may not trigger similar battles because DeSantis convinced the legislature in a special session to explicitly outlaw COVID-19 health precautions that he opposes. So schools will be on even shakier legal ground if they try to implement mask mandates in the future. And those pushing vaccine mandates could be faced with big fines from the state. Maybe Omicron will turn out to be less of a problem than Delta. Maybe it'll be worse. But one thing that seems clear is that Florida will do even less to stop the spread in the future. That wraps up another episode of Inside Florida Politics. I want to thank our audio production guru, Thomas Cordy, and thanks to all of you for listening. We're out of here.